Again, welcome. Students from O'Keefe Middle School, would the students please stand? How large is O'Keefe Middle School? How many students? Does anyone know? Yes. Well, that's wonderful. I don't know if we got 480 in this crowd in the couple of days, but we're close, and that's terrific, and I enjoyed meeting with you in the lunch hour. You may be seated, and thank you for coming. The students are here with a program, national award-winning program, run by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from private and public schools and homeschooled students are invited to come. They're given material about a case. They may have discussed these cases. And when at lunchtime, they're invited to come and speak with a judge assigned for the day. And if you were there, I was the judge assigned. The discussion is on the court and our procedures, but not on the substantive issues of the case we're about to hear or those that we heard this morning. So we will proceed with introducing the courts to you all, but I do have another group to introduce, and that's the Lakeshore Technical College students. Would they stand, please? Good, and I want to thank you for coming, and you may be seated. Marshall, Deputy Marshall, anybody here? When the Marshall comes back, we'll ask you to raise your... Mr. Pond, do you have summaries of the case? If anyone would like a summary of the case and hasn't received it, would you raise your hand so we can give you a summary? Everybody seems happy without them, so... let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated next to me, to my right, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated next to Justice Bradley is an empty chair. Justice Prosser will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I am going to go through the lineup for today's case. I do want to bring to the attention of the attorneys here that the students are going to be leaving at 2:10 p.m. No offense to whoever is speaking, but they have to make their bus and get back. So if there's too much disturbance, we'll stop the oral argument, but if not, we will proceed. This is 2012 AP 2692 CR State versus Ronnie W. Daniel. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Daniel is attorney Anthony Jurek. 20 minutes. 5 minutes for Joseph Emmon, first assistant state public defender in Madison. That's been seated 5 minutes as amicus. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin for 30 minutes is Tiffany M. Winter. And then, Mr. Jurek, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that agreeable to everybody? All right, we shall proceed. Mr. Jurek.
May it please the court. I am Anthony Jurek. My client is Roddy Daniel. The state of Wisconsin convicted a child with schizophrenia and borderline retardation of first-degree intentional homicide and burglary, and then sentenced him to life in prison, plus 15 years, without the possibility of extended supervision. This case effectively concerns his right to appeal with the assistance of counsel. Mental health issues have permeated the case, and the issues have morphed from court to court. The issues before this court are whether the burden to prove incompetency can ever be shifted to defense counsel in Wisconsin, whether the circuit court's ruling that Roddy was competent was clearly erroneous, and what the standard of review of post-conviction competency determinations should be. This court should decide that the burden cannot be shifted to defense counsel in Wisconsin, whether the posture is pre-sentencing or post-conviction, or whether the defendant and defense counsel agree as to the defendant's competency. This court should decide that the circuit court's determination that Roddy was competent was clearly erroneous. And this court should decide that a less deferential standard of review applies to post-conviction competency determinations made by the circuit court than to pre-sentencing competency determinations. Time permitting, I'll address each of those in turn. First, the burden to prove incompetency cannot be reassigned to defense counsel in Wisconsin. The burden should remain with the state whether the proceeding is before sentencing or after, and whether the defendant and defense counsel agree or disagree regarding the defendant's competency. That's true because of case law, because of the statutes the case laws incorporate, and because of the rules of professional conduct put forth by this court.
How does that position, counsel, comport with what we're instructed in Deborah A.E., that the post-conviction competency hearing should follow the same procedure so far as feasible as the pre-sentence or pre-trial?
I believe that that's very much correct, Your Honor. We're arguing simply that the rules announced in Deborah A.E. Be upheld. Deborah A.E. encourages the circuit.
So if we apply that to this case, as far as I understand it, we apply Deborah A.E., we follow 971.14.4b. Judge Wilbur, at the competency proceeding, inquired of Mr. Daniel, are you competent, to which he responded in the affirmative. And now you're saying, okay, then the burden then goes on to the state to rebut it. But what if the state agrees?
That's problematic, Justice Gableman, for a number of reasons. First, I would assert that when we look at the evolution of the statute, that it was in the 70s that it began to distinguish between the defendant and defense counsel. I would maintain that when the statute notes the defendant's assertions, that in fact it means the defense. And that's consistent with what we see of the use of the word defendant in the rest of statutes.
So in countless cases, when circuit courts have inquired of individual defendants, they've been doing so erroneously?
No, Justice Gableman. Certainly the statute in the first sentence requires the circuit court to inquire of the defendant personally. A few lines later, when it's talking about the defendant's assertion, I would maintain that what that means because of the context is the assertion of the defense, not the defendant personally. This court basically said as much in State versus Guck when it found that the court did not need to personally inquire of the defendant in order to obtain a waiver of the right to present evidence.
Okay, so when 971.14.4b says, at the commencement of the hearing, the judge shall ask the defendant whether he or she claims to be competent or incompetent. If the defendant stands mute or claims to be incompetent, the defendant shall be found incompetent, and so on. That actually means not the defendant, but it means what?
It means the defense, and I would assert that either the position of the defendant
and you define defense as defense counsel.
Defendant and defense counsel, Your Honor, I would assert that either of their positions of incompetency would require a hearing with the state bearing the burden to prove competency. And the reason I would assert that, Justice Gableman, is that throughout the criminal statutes, when the statutes refer to the defendant, common sense and context dictate that it means the defense. So when we look at 970.03 sub 5 regarding preliminary examinations, it says the defendant may cross-examine witnesses against the defendant. Clearly, that doesn't mean that the defendant personally must.
Sure, it might be a shorthand summary of the constitutional right to confront witnesses, which certainly is enjoyed by the accused, but is typically carried out by an attorney unless it's a pro se representative. So, okay.
Absolutely. And in State versus Guck, it was defense counsel's assertion on behalf of the defendant waiving the right to present evidence at a competency hearing that the court sanctioned. In other statutes, such as during initial appearances or during competency hearings, there are rights referenced that the defendant has in terms of the defendant being able to call and cross-examine witnesses. That clearly doesn't mean the defendant personally.
Well, let's go back to something you started talking about earlier, the burden. The burden shifts. The burden continues to remain with the state, you argue. But the state here is presented with, I think, three different reports that are, well, first of all, we start with the fact that the circuit court had declared Mr. Daniel to be competent at the beginning of the proceedings. So we have a court order, court determination, finding your client competent. And then after sentencing, several different reports are prepared, one indicating that he's not competent, one indicating that they can't tell because Mr. Daniel refused to cooperate with the report writer, and then one finding him competent. So is it a defensible position for the state to say, look, you know, and plus we have the backdrop of the possibility of malingering that is rife throughout the reports from the various examiners. So under these circumstances, is it at least defensible that a prosecutor, a representative of the prosecutor, would say, we agree with Mr. Daniel based on this record, and we're not going to argue that he's incompetent?
Unfortunately, Justice Gableman, the prosecutor's express intention in this case, as he indicated in his written summation, was to avoid a post-conviction determination of incompetency because he feared that it might be used as a springboard to challenge the determination that Roddy was competent to stand trial. I don't think that that's an appropriate consideration for a prosecutor to have, but he wrote on the record that that's what his objective was.
So our court, we should be bound by the subjective intent of the prosecutor? We shouldn't look at the record to determine whether the prosecution's decision was appropriate or not, supported by the evidence or not?
I think that if this court does look at the evidence to see if the prosecutor's decision was supported and if the court's, the circuit court's determination of competency was supported, that this court would be left with the firm conviction that a mistake had been made. It was addressed thoroughly at briefing in the appellate courts where the
I'm pretty sure that was a no. We're not bound by the subjective stated intent of a prosecutor.
No, that's correct.
Does your argument hinge on us determining that the word defendant means defendant and defense counsel in total?
It does not.
I mean, when you read through the competency proceedings, it really does generally distinguish between, you know, the examination of the defendant. They don't mean the examination of the defendant and defense counsel. It talks about defense counsel's rights to do certain things, the state's obligations to do certain things, and the defendant's opportunity to do certain things. It seems to me that, while I get what you're saying, in certain parts they refer to them sort of together, the defendant has the right. In the competency proceedings, it sure does look like they kind of parse that out and speak specifically to the defendant, defense counsel, and the state. So that's why I wanted to make sure that your argument wasn't hinging too much on that, because I'm not sure you're right. Unless you want to convince me of that a little more somehow.
Well, all I would have to say further about the statutes is to offer further examples where the word defendant in the context of criminal statutes clearly means the defense.
I don't disagree with you at all, and in part that might be, because there might be cases where a defendant represents himself, and other cases where the defense as a whole is engaging in the representation. But when you're talking about the issue of a individual's competency to proceed, and that individual is specifically the defendant. And when you look at the context of these statutes where it regularly uses the terms the district attorney, the defendant, and defense counsel, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say that the word defendant means defense counsel in these statutes, but I'm happy to be convinced more, but that's just how I'm looking at it based on the words.
I appreciate that analysis, Justice Ziegler, and I wouldn't say that it is absolutely clear that that's what the statute means. It is in that sense ambiguous, as this court discussed in State versus Gough.
Do you think it's the same analysis? Let's just say, you know, I've had this experience where you have defense counsel and they're in a little bit of a tough position because they're sitting there saying their client may not be competent to proceed. And they may or may not agree, the client may or may not agree, especially depending on how competent they may or may not be, right? And so, you know, you don't push too far asking the lawyer why they think that. But then as a judge, you know, you decide if you're going to order a competency evaluation, that sort of thing. Do you think it's a different analysis in any way when it comes to post-conviction determinations?
I tend to agree with the concurrence in the Court of Appeals decision, both parts where it said that the majority opinion and the concurrence where it said that it's a distinction without much of a difference. I don't think that it matters, except to the extent that the state pointed out in their brief that a court has no discretion for pre-sentencing competency determinations as opposed to, I would say, a kind of narrow latitude under Deborah A.E., that a circuit court in its discretion may have a hearing.
Yeah, at the initial competency hearing, let's say I find the person not competent to proceed. Then there's a specific evaluation, a place they go, a time period for which they is the maximum amount of time they can be there. Everything sort of goes on hold, waiting for them to regain competency. When you're at the appellate level, you've been convicted of a crime, you have certain appellate rights to proceed on, and your conviction doesn't change if you become incompetent. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a different scenario. It's not like at the appellate level you say, oh, I guess I'm not going to have you be in prison, or I'm just not going to have you go serve your jail, or you're not on probation. It's not like you all of a sudden fill the forms out and they go receive some mental health treatment. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a little different by necessity. I mean, what do you do with that finding and proceeding?
I do understand, Justice Ziegler, and I would say that it does complicate the issue somewhat. I would say that the defendant does still have a liberty interest, although that liberty interest is much more attenuated. And because that liberty interest, so I would use
actually could hurt the defendant. I mean, seriously, let's say they've got a great appellate issue, but they're not competent, and they could win on the appellate issue. So they still sit in prison while they're regaining competency, or what happens to them? What happens?
I believe that Deborah A.E. Hit it on the head when it suggested that the appointment of a guardian would be appropriate.
But the guardian doesn't change their sentence.
That's correct. And so proceeding with an appeal to the extent possible while a client might be regaining or attaining competence is in fact suggested by Deborah A.E. However, this case presents a unique fact circumstance in that one of the manifestations of my client's oscillating occasional desire not to pursue post-conviction relief, which might change from week to week, is that he sometimes expresses that desire not to pursue post-conviction relief as a desire to terminate representation. Now, you had asked whether interpretation of the word defendant from the statute is what our position hinges on, and it is not. We also look to State versus Meeks and to the rules of professional conduct put forth by this court.
Let me ask you about that. The scenario is he's had a competency hearing before trial, finding of competence. They go to trial. We're not in appeals yet, right? He's sentenced. Now we're in post-conviction relief back at the trial court, right?
Yes.
Is that right? And he says, I'm competent to go ahead on post-conviction relief. I may not want it, but I'm competent, okay? And the state says, yes, he's competent. Now, what is the obligation of defense counsel at that moment when defense counsel thinks that the client is not competent? I thought that Johnson took the position, Justice Day wrote that, that where Johnson had letters from experts saying, not Johnson, Johnson's counsel, defense counsel, had letters of indication that the defendant was not competent. The lawyer there did not tell the court that, didn't tell, as far as I could tell, the defendant that. Now the defendant finds out there was this doubt, and he gets his conviction overturned, doesn't he? And isn't the obligation of the counsel to bring that to the court's attention as an officer of the court?
Johnson does require us, defense attorneys, to raise competency when there is any reason to doubt it.
Okay, so in this case, the defendant says, I'm swell. The state says, he's swell. Defense counsel says, well, I'm not so sure he's swell, right? I've got doubt. I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't tell. But I have doubts. I'm his defense counsel. What do I have to do?
So step one is to raise the issue to the court.
I tell the court, I've got doubts, court.
The court then orders an examination.
What orders an examination?
Which
okay.
Would result in the production of a report by a mental health professional.
Or more than one report. And they may not be consistent, right?
Correct. And then it would come back to the court again for a hearing.
On what?
On competency.
All right.
And so in this case, all of the credible evidence presented at that post-conviction competency hearing indicated that the defendant was incompetent. And that issue was thoroughly briefed to the Court of Appeals, which decided not to decide the issue, but to decide it on grounds we neither raised nor argued. The dilemma that defense counsel is in a case such as this, is that under Johnson, we have to raise competency when we have reason to doubt it, mm-hmm. and under Meeks, we can't do much more than that.
Okay.
Under Meeks, former defense counsel was prohibited from testifying as to a defendant's, a previous client's competency.
Confidential information here.
Sure. I don't think the fact, and Meeks noted that there is a tension that present counsel alone is saddled with between the mandate in Johnson, the prohibition in Meeks. I think that the difficulty in Meeks isn't mitigated by the fact that I'm presently Roddy's counsel, but rather that tension and difficulty is magnified.
Okay, I just want to go through the steps. Now, the lawyer defense counsel says, I got doubts. We get experts appointed. We now have a hearing before the trial court. This is all part of the post-conviction relief, right? We have a hearing before the trial court to determine competency. If I understand the case, at that hearing, the burden was put on defense counsel to prove, was it incompetency, by clear and convincing evidence. Is that right?
That's correct, Chief
All
Justice.
All right. At the same time that Johnson says it's your job to raise competency, and Meek says
Hey.
You can't do much other than raise it. But now you've got the burden of proof. Now, that's your problem, isn't it?
It is.
All right. So then the question is, how do we resolve that? And if I understand you and if I understand the amicus, you, this side of the table, resolves it by saying the burden should be on the state. Once the question is raised, even though the state has taken a position, the burden is on the state, and it's on the state by the preponderance of evidence, the lower burden of proof. Is that right? Is that your position?
That the burden is on the state. That's correct.
That's your position.
Yes, absolutely. And that mitigates any concerns occasioned by the tension between Johnson and Meeks.
And if the burden is on the state, the burden didn't meet it here because you had the burden and it was a higher burden.
It was, and the Court of Appeals was entirely correct in that observation that under Cooper versus Oklahoma.
That's the case I'm referring to about what the standard of proof is.
Right, that the clear and convincing standard was too high. However, the difficulty with the Court of Appeals application in Cooper versus Oklahoma in this case is that Wisconsin has exactly the opposite statutory construction as Oklahoma does.
Right. I understand that, too. But then the issue also becomes to me that if you put the state with the burden, then the issue you haven't gotten to from my perspective, which you said is one of the issues, is what do we do and why should we appoint a guardian? Right? Or does this just go back and we don't have to worry about what we do thereafter? Because we don't know what the court is going to do, the trial court.
It's important that we would do something like appoint a guardian. And the reason that's important is because there are rights of the defendant, enjoyed by the defendant alone, such as to decide whether to appeal and what the objectives of an appeal are, as delineated in Deborah A.E.
He already has a lawyer. The problem is the lawyer and he are not on the same side on confidence. That's why you want the guardian, isn't it?
Exactly, to make those decisions allocated to the defendant by law, which are not in my domain. Supreme Court rules allow me to take protective action in order to prevent him from harming himself by, say, accepting a conviction by which he'll die in prison. However, it would not, in my opinion, permit me to fully press an appeal against his wishes when perhaps every other week or month he wants to discontinue representation.
So there are guardians and there are guardians. There are guardians that can be advocates, and there are guardians that are assisting the court with respect to what's best for the subject of the guardianship. What kind of a guardian is this? And are you saying the appellate proceedings or post-conviction relief continues on? It's just the guardian becomes the defendant if the defendant's found not competent?
I am not.
Work.
I'm sorry?
How does it work? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Sure. And I am not positive what kind of guardian it would be, whether it's the advocate guardian or a different sort. What's important is that a guardian with, in consultation probably with Roddy to the extent possible, would make decisions that are Roddy's alone, whether to appeal, and importantly, what the objectives of an appeal would be. There are some.
Kind of sounds to me like you're just saying he needs a new lawyer.
No, because I'm sorry. Those decisions are outside the domain of counsel. For counsel to make those decisions would be to infringe on.
Is the guardian a lawyer?
I don't know that Deborah A.E. specifies that. What sort of guardian or mechanism? It simply says that a guardian might be appointed. And so I don't know that it has to be a lawyer. For instance, at Roddy's commitment hearings, he's been represented by counsel for his continuing commitments under Chapter 51 while he's in prison concerning his medication.
But that's different. I mean, Chapter 51 is different from the kind of commitment you're talking about here, at least as I see it.
Correct. So the important thing would be that he has a competent individual able to make those decisions for him in the meantime.
So it's not that things stop. Like, competency would typically happen, you know, if someone's found incompetent at trial or, you know, before trial, the proceedings stop. And at the appellate level, if someone's found not competent, the proceedings go forward, but the guardian is endowed with the ability to make all the decisions the defendant would otherwise make if the defendant were competent, and then the guardian tells defense counsel what to do?
That's my understanding, Justice Ziegler.
Does that come from? I know it comes from Deborah A.E., but I have to look at it closer. Is that?
That is the only place I'm aware of it coming
okay,
from.
Okay, so it's not.
The red light is on. If I could just wrap up a response that question.
You would go ahead, but then you have 5 minutes of rebuttal, so do it quickly, please. Okay.
In terms of the guardian, this particular case has a defendant with a life sentence plus 15 years, and so it can't get a lot worse in terms of sentencing. However, in other cases, a guardian for an incompetent may say, well, the risk of pursuing an appeal is too great. You know, there's a chance that the person may be incarcerated longer, or they would be able to weigh the defendant's interests apart from the legal analysis that appellate counsel provides.
Boy, what kind of a review will that be? You know, we have Mockner hearings, we have Rothering, we have, you know, that'll be a whole new level of ineffective assistance as a guardian, I guess, huh?
I don't know, Your Honor.
That'll be interesting. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Amicus.
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Eamon, amicus, representing the state public defender. I'm going to get right to the statute because that's where rubber meets the road here, kind of. I hope we can all agree that an incompetent defendant can't be compelled to go to trial or proceed with an appeal. So in the hypothetical, you've got a defendant who's not competent, defense counsel does his job, raises it, court orders an exam says not competent, but maybe it's marginal, but comes out with that. So you go to the hearing, and now the hearing under the statute splits the three people out at the beginning. Defense counsel, defendant, and state all have to agree to waive a hearing. They don't, because the defendant who's not competent says, I'm competent, which, you know, isn't typical, but isn't all that uncommon. I think you've run into that in 51 cases a lot, where the forced meds and that defendant who's clearly not competent says that he is. So you go to the hearing. And the judge is required to ask the defendant whether he claims to be competent or incompetent. The defendant may not understand that, but you ask somebody, are you competent? The answer is yes, generally. So he says yes. If you take that to mean just the defendant, you skip down a line to if the defendant claims to be competent, the defendant shall be found competent. The court's required to, unless the state presents evidence showing that he's not. If the state doesn't want him to be found competent because they either don't believe the report or they think he's malingering, they can just stand mute and the court shall find him competent. Under that scenario, the statute would seem to compel an incompetent person to proceed to trial. And in fact, I can tell you that happens. I mean, from our perspective, I think that violates due process. And the public defender's asking you to do to fix that is to read defendant as meaning the defense, meaning, yes, defendant and defense counsel, and clarify that at the hearing, the Johnson obligation extends to defense counsel to tell the court, yes, my client claims to be competent. I do not. And defense counsel shouldn't be required to explain anything more than, I raised it, I don't believe anything's changed. And then in that scenario, you just proceed to the next line where the defendant shall be found incompetent unless the state proves by credible evidence that the defendant is competent. And in that scenario, the state's burden will be pretty easy. If the defendant is competent, and you know the defendant would have a right to take the stand, the defendant or the state could question him and show, demonstrate for the court that he fully well understands what's going on. He could present the report and point out the problems in the report, but it would be the state's burden to do that. And that, it's, while it's not a perfect solution, I think it's a solution that sort of saves the statute in terms of due process, to read it that way. And, you know, I concede, you know, that having it, the defendant mean something else earlier in the paragraph is a little bit unusual. But that paragraph, that language was created in response to a metallic case, a case from 40 years ago, where the old statute just put this in the hands of the prosecutor and defense counsel. They made the decision, and the defendant sitting off to the side, wait a minute, no, I'm confident, had no say in it. And this court ruled that that wasn't wrong, that that was wrong. The defendant should be able to demonstrate for the court their competence. And what the public defender is asking you to do allows that. The defendant's still maintaining his competence. He doesn't waive the hearing. He gets the hearing, and he gets to demonstrate at the hearing with the prosecutor's assistance, if that's what the prosecutor wants, that he's competent. And if the prosecutor agrees with defense counsel, the court could do the questioning under that scenario. But I think it protects the defendant, gives the state the opportunity to get what it wants, and saves the statute. So yes, defendant does mean defendant and defense counsel at that point. And Johnson could be extended to apply at the hearing. Defense counsel still has the obligation to just raise the point.
Counsel, does it matter to your argument and how you want to look at the statute whether a defendant was in the same proceedings at the trial level already determined to be competent?
Yeah, competence is a fluid thing. It's not that unusual for somebody to be incompetent for a period, regain it, even within the same proceeding. And especially with appeal, difference between trial and appeal, the beginning and something that may be many months or a year later. It's relevant, arguably, but it's certainly not determinative to talk about what his state was.
Period here between the competence hearing before trial and the and this post-conviction.
I don't know. He'll be able to answer that.
He can answer that when it's
yeah.
his turn.
Right, exactly.
Do you differ any in your argument and in your brief from the defendant?
Not in a big way, no. I mean, I'm saying yes, that the defendant means defendant and defense counsel, and he wavered on that a little bit, and then the public defender believes, yeah, that's exactly what it means. But no, our position, I think, is consistent. And I also just want to explain to the court, you know, anecdotally, that's generally how it works around the state. You know, but we do get these cases at the trial level where there's stasis. You've got this report, a defendant who's, you know, clearly not competent, but a prosecutor who wants to move forward. And the two options are either the case sits, and there's two cases like that now, but that's trying to figure out what to do with them, or an incompetent defendant proceeds to trial. And that's how it works if you...
Counsel, from a practical standpoint, a real-world practical standpoint, besides the wedge issue, which it seems to me is going to be there anyway if there's a difference of opinion between the one represented, the client, and the attorney about the competence, wouldn't it be the defense counsel who is raising the concern about incompetence? Wouldn't the defense counsel be in the best position, and it seems to me perhaps most predictably reliable, to go to every extent possible to establish that?
Sure. You could do that in some other states. That is the rule. But under Wisconsin law, which, you know, I concede doesn't necessarily apply on appeal, you could make something completely different on appeal.
Well, since we're everyone so far has urged us to make something up.
Yeah. Right. But
anticipate the state
that,
will.
That scenario basically destroys the attorney-client relationship, and it would require, I think, a rewrite of a lot of Wisconsin law.
All right. So it's a small wedge if the attorney raises it, but it's irreparable.
Yeah, as a practical matter, yeah.
Since we're talking practicalities, you've got the alternative that's being presented so far is that we, you know, continue to assign the burden to the state, which you already pointed out may or may not be interested in establishing that.
Right. The state will always be interested under my scenario, because if the split requires the state to prove the defendant to be competent, and that's what the state believes he is.
By giving the defense counsel the ability, by interpreting the statute as defense counsel. Okay.
Right. And the state can, you know, rely on the report. It can, you know, bring the expert in. And if the defendant is claiming to be competent and willing to testify, you know, the state could present that.
And meanwhile, it seems to me that hinges, though, on us interpreting the statute the way Mr. Jurek, or Jurek,
Jurek
urged upon us,
yes,
that instead of a defendant, so what happens to the defendant then? Are we putting him or her back in the position where what they have to say about their own competency doesn't really matter?
No, it does, because they could choose to explain to the court that the court could put the defendant on the stand to explain, look, no, I understand perfectly well, and, you know, recite chapter and verse about, yeah, I get, you know, what's going on, why I'm here, and, you know, could explain to the court, could demonstrate his competence at a hearing.
Again, reading, it seems to me we're going to have to, there's interpretation of statutes, and then there's an interpretation of statutes. So that would be another one where we'd have to kind of reach in, and because really the statute, as I read it, just says the judge has the obligation to ask, to inquire of the defendant, and then so the defendant says, Your Honor, I'm competent, or yeah, in answer to the question, are you competent? And then if the defense lawyer says something different, no, Your Honor, he's incompetent, then we're assigning part of the burden of proof to the one who is claimed to be competent. I'm just trying to think this out in the real world.
Well,
you're saying, I mean, he's got the opportunity to be called by the judge. Well, I don't know how any
state,
of us...
Because the state is going to want him to be competent. That's the scenario here. So he has an advocate. Because if the state doesn't want him to be competent either, because he's, you know.
My point is, and I'm just asking you to address this, either way, I don't think any of us would want to be put in the position of having to be, you know, have a judge ask, are you competent or incompetent? And we say, competent, Your Honor. Well, that's fine, but the person sitting next to you says you're incompetent, so come on up to the witness stand. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I understand, but it's almost sort of inconceivable in my experience that a defense lawyer would say somebody who's even borderline not competent is not competent. I mean, as a practical matter, it's got to be pretty far out there. We deal with mentally ill people all the time.
I know. As a former trial court judge, I know. But then the other thing, as a former trial court judge, where's the stopping point? There's a declaration of competency or determination. Then next week, defense counsel or post-trial counsel raises it again. I mean,
There constitutionally can be no stopping point.
There's what?
There constitutionally can be no stopping point. If defense counsel cannot communicate with his client, cannot get the client to understand, he has to raise it all the time. I can't make the decision for the client. And then if you want to talk about the guardian thing a little bit, I can address that really quickly.
Go ahead.
You don't get to get to the guardian point until the person is declared not competent. So it's sort of a cart before the horse thing. And once he's incompetent, there can be a guardian, and the guardian basically is a person who's in the shoes of the defendant. And I can tell you, none of this happens very often, but we have had guardian cases, and, yeah, the guardian can make a decision to not proceed with plea withdrawal because it would clearly harm the person, even though there's a great issue, but they'd be worse off. But it's a you don't get to the guardian until you get we can't foist the guardian on somebody who's not incompetent.
Okay.
Great.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the state. Ms. Winter.
May it please the court. My name is Tiffany Winter, and I am the Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. I would also like to start with the statute, because the state believes that the language of the statute is plain and should be given its plain meaning. It clearly says that the court shall address the defendant and ascertain whether or not the defendant believes he or she is competent or incompetent. It does not contemplate asking that same question of defense counsel, because defense counsel obligation comes before we ever get to that step, in which they must raise to the court that they are questioning the defendant's competence to stand trial. When we look to the legislative history of 971.14, it supports that plain language reading of the statute. The opponent has asserted that the statute was changed in response to Metallic versus Schubert, which was decided in 1973. That is true, but that is true of the 1981 version of the statute, in which they changed the first sentence, requiring the court to address the defendant, the prosecutor, and defense counsel as to whether or not they waive the right to present additional evidence. The 1981 version of the statute as to the issue of the burden of proof simply said that the party seeking to prove incompetence has the burden to do so. The statute in its current form changed in 1987 and was in response to the Judicial Council Committee's Committee on the Insanity Defense, in which they determined that in response to Blywell versus Franzen and Addington versus Texas, there must be a personal inquiry of the defendant to determine whether or not the defendant is asserting competence or incompetence.
Counsel, let's say your read of the statute is correct. But it seems to me that if it is, the statute doesn't take into consideration what I would call the Johnson and the Meeks jurisprudence. Johnson, which states that there is an obligation of the defense attorney to raise the competency issue, and Meeks, which says, yeah, but you can't do anything about it other than raise it. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially because of the confidentiality requirements. You can't talk about any communications. You can't discuss your perceptions. And indeed, Meeks reversed the Court of Appeals on that. So let's say you're right on the statute, but then how do you fill in how do you address under Johnson and Meeks the reality of someone saying post-conviction, I think he's incompetent. Doesn't the defense attorney have the obligation to raise that?
Absolutely. And what the court is presenting does not change that obligation at all, mm-hmm. because that obligation occurs way before we get to the hearing.
Sure. But that obligation, I think, because mental illness is not static, because even in Meeks, it says, given the nature of mental illness, the defendant may have been competent during a prior proceeding, but incompetent now, and vice versa. I mean, we all know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the defense attorney has the obligation under Johnson and the Constitution to raise it whenever it arises.
That is correct.
Okay, then if he has the obligation to raise it whenever it arises,
but under meets is foreclosed because of the obvious confidentiality and conflict of interest concerns. It seems to me the avenue, the answer is then for the state to have the burden to show competency to the consistent with 971.14 to the extent possible in this kind of post-conviction stuff. So what I want you to respond is kind of take issue with me, if you will. Even if the statute says what you say it says, isn't there an obligation under Johnson and Meeks? That's my bottom line question.
I have a two-part response to that. And the first part is I think that this is a great opportunity for this court to reconcile Meeks and Johnson, because what occurred in Meeks is the present counsel called former counsel, not in different proceedings on the same case, but from different cases altogether, and asked that counsel to testify in the current case as to whether or not she believed in former cases that there was reason to doubt that defendant's competency. And so what Meeks is really discussing is whether or not a former attorney can be called in a competency hearing to offer testimony as proof of competency or incompetency. And I think it is very clear under the privilege statute or the privilege rule that is not okay. What Johnson is saying is that current counsel has the obligation to raise the issue of competency whenever they have reason to doubt it. And if you read Johnson, it goes further to also say that there is an obligation to turn over the evidence that the counsel had at the time in order that raised the doubt of competency. Like in this case, in Johnson, the issue was that the defendant had multiple reports that questioned whether or not the defendant was competent to go to trial. The court in Johnson said not only does he have to raise that, but he has an obligation to provide that evidence to the court. And I think that's how we reconcile Meeks and Johnson.
Well, didn't Meeks itself reconcile itself with Johnson? And although you're correct that the context of Meeks is with regard to a former client, the discussion and the reconciliation of Meeks with Johnson isn't focused on a former client situation. It's broader than that. In paragraphs 42, where it says State versus Johnson, and discusses it in 42 through 50.
Yes, but the state is not asking that the counsel for the defendant ever have to testify in court or divulge any competences of his client in the competency hearing.
It isn't just a matter of testifying, though, it seems to me. It isn't just a matter of divulging specific testimony and things that were said. Meeks goes broader than that, of course, talking about perceptions and opinions, because those perceptions and opinions are based on verbal and nonverbal communication. That's what Meeks says. So, I mean, I think this is a difficult case. I don't know. There are policy concerns. There are legal arguments and precedent that can go a variety of ways. Others may see it differently. I think this is a tough case, but you've got Meeks, you've got Johnson, and regardless if this fits nicely in the words of 971.14.4b, it seems with those two cases as precedent, we've got a situation we're faced with today that gives us some tools on how to handle it.
Correct, and that is why the state advocated that this court take the opportunity to depart from a strict application of 971.14 subsection 4, because Deborah A.E. never required that strict application. It simply said to follow that to the extent feasible. And as the state briefed, the requirement for a defendant to personally address the court to personally address the defendant had to deal with whether or not the defendant was asserting that he was agreeing that his liberty interests may be deprived before an adjudication of guilt. The establishment of the presumptions of competence or incompetence and the corresponding burdens in 971.14 subsection 4b are entirely specific to competency to stand trial. And Deborah A.E. was clear that post-conviction competency determinations are different than determinations of competency to stand trial. In the post-conviction context, the question that we are asking is whether or not the defendant can assist counsel and make decisions committed by law with a reasonable degree of rational understanding. The decision committed by law to the defendant in this case is whether or not he would like to initiate post-conviction review. The defendant has said that he does not. Counsel had questions regarding his competency. He rightly raised competency to the court. The court found there was reason to do an evaluation. An evaluation was done. The evaluator found Rhodey, Daniel, to arguably be competent. Daniel said to the court, yes, I am competent. I understand what's going on to some extent. The state will concede that his understanding of the appellate process is limited, but the understanding of the appellate process is limited for the majority of people. Some attorneys don't understand the appellate process. So simply because Mr. Daniel did not understand the appellate process is not a factor in determining whether or not he is competent, because that is not the question on post-conviction.
You can't push it out there and say, well, because he doesn't understand all of the rules of appellate procedure, doesn't mean, well, of course it doesn't. I mean, didn't this guy, wasn't he talking about whether or not he was going to be pleading guilty in post-conviction stuff? I mean, did he, at least it raises a concern that if he still thinks he's at the stage of whether or not he should be pleading and admitting to it, maybe it doesn't quite know what universe he's in the, I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean the universe in terms of what area of the proceeding he's in.
Yes, he did say that he thought he would be pleading guilty by foregoing post-conviction review. But that could also be taking that he was acknowledging that he was admitting guilt, that he was guilty for that crime. In fact, he sent a letter to the judge after the post-conviction proceeding saying that he did, in fact, kill the victim and that he was guilty. So the inartful term, for a lack of a better word, of pleading guilty could have just been his way of saying, I understand if I do not do post-conviction review that I will be accepting my conviction and my sentence. And to the point that the state has asked this court to establish a rule, or not a rule, establish that when a defendant is found competent, that he should be presumed competent until proven otherwise, that is fully consistent with what happens in the context of competency to stand trial. If competency is raised and a defendant is found to be incompetent and he is committed, he is presumed to continue to be incompetent until competency is brought back to the court and a new determination is made. The same if he is found competent. He is presumed to continue incompetence until the issue is raised again. So there is no departure from what actually happens in competency determinations for what the state is asking for.
Well, as I understand it, you want the burden at this post-conviction competency hearing. You want the defense counsel to have the burden to prove incompetency. And I understand that you think that the burden should be the first burden of preponderance of the evidence. Is that right?
That is correct.
Now, the defendant thinks you ought to have the burden. The state ought to have the burden. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for everyone not to want the burden, right? Because burdens are burdens.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the matter with, in all due respect, of saying to the state, you've got the burden to prove that this person is competent. You brought the original charges. You brought the trial. You won. Now we're in a second or third, whatever phase you're in. And, hey, the issue is still, can the state proceed with this guy if there's a mental health problem, an incompetency problem? So I can understand why the state doesn't want the burden, right? Nobody ever wants the burden. And if you got the burden, you want to be able to show it at the least level of the three levels of burden. But it seems to me that it's so much cleaner and easier and fits with all the prior proceedings and the whole concept here that the burden's on the state. You want to try him? Now, I know that they're bringing the post-conviction, not you, but it's still part of that. So what's the matter other than you don't want the burden?
I think in this case, Rody Daniel was already proven to be competent.
That was, what date was that?
I believe the competency hearing, I don't have the exact date, but if I'm remembering the record correctly, the competency hearing was roughly a year before the post-conviction.
Okay. In a year, a lot can happen. In fact, I could make the argument that if it were a month where you got somebody who's a little unstable, has problems, I mean, just by calling a competency hearing, you already have reason to believe there may be a problem. You may not believe that he's incompetent, but you got a problem, right?
Yes.
So a year ago, you had a problem. You decide it's good enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one understands everything, and I think you're absolutely right about lawyers not understanding the appellate process. And I'll tell you, judges don't either, and I can cite cases. But now you got a year later. Year is a lifetime, and a person can have been incompetent for 2 months and then competent again and incompetent, etc. So although I don't know what I do, whether there's a presumption of competence on this second hearing and post-conviction, but you clearly have a problem.
I agree.
And I don't know what presumptions mean. There's a whole chapter on presumptions, and I don't know if you're talking about a presumption, or you're talking about an inference, or you're talking about a rebuttable presumption and what it takes to rebut. Is it rebuttable by bringing in proof or some evidence, produce evidence, or is it a stronger presumption that, you know, presumption is a very odd word in the law. If I don't understand criminal appeals, I sure don't understand presumptions. Do you?
To some extent, I would say.
That's my point. To some extent.
Right.
Okay, tell me the extent.
In this case, I would argue that the statute, 971.14, subsection 4B, is establishing rebuttable presumptions based on the defendant's assertion. They're telling the court what they must find unless proven otherwise, so that's a presumption based on the defendant's assertion that can be rebutted by the standard of proof depending on whether or not the defendant is claiming to be competent or incompetent. The reason why the state is asking this court to depart from that establishment of rebuttable presumptions based on the defendant's assertion is because the creation of that statute was specific to competency to stand trial. And the response to Addington versus Texas, which was a civil commitment case, and in response to Blyle versus Franzen, which was a Seventh Circuit case out of Illinois, in which the Seventh Circuit found that it was improper under the Illinois statute to place the burden on the defendant to always prove incompetency if that's what the defendant is seeking to prove. That is what the statute said in 1981. Whoever was seeking to prove incompetency had the burden to do so. And so the statute was changed in 1987. They attempted to change it in 85, but they couldn't get it through the legislature, so it changed in 87. And the Judicial Council Committee's notes on the statute made it clear that when they were entering, because it was their amendment that was ultimately adopted, that the state was burdened with proving incompetency when that was the state's position. The Judicial Council meeting notes from November 15, 1985 are very clear on that. The statute was not created to burden the state in all circumstances in proving whatever position is contrary to that the defendant took. And that is essentially what defense counsel is asking be applied on post-conviction competency determinations, that if the defendant says that he's competent, the state should have to prove the opposite.
I understood at least the amicus to be arguing differently. My understanding might be wrong, but I understood the amicus to be saying that the state then have the situation as here. The defendant says, I'm competent. Defense attorney raises competency. the burden is on the state, but the state's burden is to show competency.
That is their argument if you accept the proposition that once the defendant says he's competent, if defense counsel disagrees, that defense counsel assertions trump the defendant's. That is what they're asking. They're asking to go from the first part of the statute that says if the defendant, or it's actually the second, but if the defendant claims to be competent, he shall be found competent. So they're saying ignore that because defense counsel is saying that he's incompetent and we want you to read defendant as the defense. And so they're asking, essentially what they're doing by asking the court to do that is taking an artful way of saying we want the state to always prove the position contrary to the defendant.
I don't hear that. I mean, I look at this statute. You've given the history and done it quite well. You know, of course, Meeks was decided in 2003. I think that this 971.14.4b doesn't necessarily contemplate the situation we have here. And we address that sort of thing all the time. That's one of the reasons we're so busy. And that is things that maybe weren't contemplated quite in the same way. New facts come up. You think you have everything settled, and lo and behold, a new fact situation comes up that something you thought was clear and settled now isn't quite so clear and not quite so settled. So it doesn't startle me that maybe 971.14.4b doesn't nicely fit with our fact situation. But we have cases since then. And I just, I hear Annika saying that the burden is on the state. They would be having a showing of competency. In fact, Amicus went on to say, in essence, that would be kind of like the adversary counsel for, I don't mean in essence, but akin to taking the same position and advocating the same position as the defendant is here.
I think the cases since the revision to the statute are clear that what my opponent is asking for, either the opponent or the amicus, is not how the statute operates. The statute does contemplate that the defendant and the defense counsel will disagree at times, and it contemplates that in the very first sentence when it says the defendant, the defense counsel, and the prosecutor all must waive the hearing. So there is a contemplation that there will be a disagreement. The cases also support that it is the defendant's assertion and the competency to stand trial context that creates the presumption of competence or incompetence. And those cases go on to find that that personal assertion by the defendant does not preclude the defense counsel from providing information to the court. And you could follow that from Johnson, where defense counsel was required to provide the court not just with his question of competency, but also the reports as with evidence that the defendant may, in fact, be incompetent. We can also look to State versus Wanta, in which it was clear that the defendant and defense counsel did not agree whether or not Wanta was competent to proceed. However, in that case, the state also did not agree that Wanta was competent to proceed. So there was a little bit of a different factual situation there. But the statute is not completely unhelpful in this context. I think it is clear that the state has the burden to prove a position that they are looking to prove. I do not think the statute saddles the state with the burden in all circumstances. If the defendant is claiming to be competent in the context, again, of competency to stand trial, and the state does not disapprove of that position, they have no reason to believe, based on the court-ordered report, which they would have had time to review before the hearing, that the defendant is, in fact, incompetent, then why should the state be required to take a position to argue something that they believe is contrary to the evidence before the state? It is the defense counsel in this case that was in the possession of the information that they thought would show that Mr. Daniel was incompetent. It was not their own perception. It was not defense counsel's testimony. It was reports. It was information from the individuals at the Wisconsin Resource Center. There is no indication that by providing that evidence, defense counsel was in any way not representing his client And rather, he was providing the information to the court as an advocate. And we see this multiple times in the context of defense counsel and his client disagreeing. The duty of the counsel is to investigate and then determine the best course of action. For example, in a criminal trial, a defendant and his counsel may be in complete disagreement as to what defense to actually assert to the court. And counsel has an obligation to investigate the defenses. The counsel does not have the obligation to put forward a defense unsupported by the evidence simply because his defendant wants him to. Similarly, in the appellate context, a post-conviction counsel has an obligation to investigate the case, to determine whether or not there are meritorious issues for review, and then to counsel his client. If he finds that there are no issues for review, but his counsel disagrees, he's not required then to actually take his counsel's take his client's position and advocate for that. So criminal law has a lot of areas in which counsel and their client are not going to agree on that. That disagreement does not mean that counsel is no longer not functioning as counsel. And that's what they are asking the court to find here when they're talking about their ethical obligation. They're saying that they can't function as counsel if they're not advocating for their client's position. And that is simply not true. That's not what we require of counsel. We require them to investigate, we require them to communicate, and require them to counsel. We do not require them to blindly follow their client's wishes. He has a duty to the court to provide the court with the information necessary for the determination. While the state may have had that information because it was turned over to the state prior to the hearing, he is still in the best position to provide the court with that information. The state does not know why, or does not have the history with the psychiatric evaluator that counsel did, because counsel spoke with the evaluator before Daniel spoke with him. The state does not have the history with the individual at the Wisconsin Resource Center that was called, that counsel called to communicate what happened in between their conversations with the client while that individual was present. The state would have no way to actually present that evidence in the same manner that defense counsel would. That's why the notions of convenience would establish that the defense counsel is the one that should be providing that information to the court. And there is no, I think, as the state pointed out in their brief, when we get bogged down into thinking of this as a traditional burden of persuasion, that's when we try to make these ethical issues arise that maybe aren't really quite there to the extent that we think they are. There are a variety of contexts in which the court is looking to figure out what the defendant wants to do and whether or not they are asserting a right or waiving a right. And it is the court that is taking information and trying to make a determination. There's not a particular party that is burdened with proving that.
So do you want the court, and I read that in your brief, do you want the court to say, no one has a burden, just everybody bring it in and I'll decide? That what the what do you want this court to say in its opinion? Do you want it to say the burden is on defense counsel by the lower standard? Is it it's on the state by the lower standard? Or nobody has the burden? Just bring in the evidence. The court makes a decision. And if it's evenly divided, what does the court do?
I think that this court needs to establish what quantum of proof is required.
Okay, so
whether
what's the quantum
it's clear and convincing or preponderance of evidence.
What is your suggestion?
I believe that it, under the application of Cooper versus Oklahoma, because we're now out of the context of competency to stand trial, we no longer have the deprivation of liberty issue, it has to be preponderance of the evidence.
Okay, so you and the defendant agree on that?
Yes.
So, all right, we move from the level to who has the burden of proof, or is there a burden of proof?
I don't think there is a burden of proof.
Okay. So the defendant doesn't have a burden of proof. You don't have a burden of proof.
Correct.
No burden of proof. All this comes in,
mm-hmm.
right? All the evidence comes in. The defense counsel says, oh, I don't know. You get a little problem here, judge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the judge says, okay, you bring in evidence. You bring in evidence. I bring in all your expert reports. You don't really even have to have a hearing. I mean, it all can be done on paper, right?
Correct.
As I understand it. Okay. Now, the judge is on the line and is everything looks equal. You know, that happens. And the way to dispose of the case is who has the burden. If you haven't met the burden, you lose, right? So what does the judge do when it's all even Steven?
I think that we can find some guidance in the context of hearings in which a defendant is attempting to relinquish a right. I understand that you can never relinquish your right to not be tried while you are incompetent, but I think we can find some guidance in those areas. When a court, for example, conducts a plea colloquy when the defendant is relinquishing his right to trial, the court has to determine whether or not the defendant is voluntarily, freely, and intelligently relinquishing that right. In doing that, they're conducting a colloquy with the defendant, they're considering the evidence, they ask for input from defense counsel. Now, if
somebody has this burden there, whether there's been a voluntary, intelligent relinquishment of a right.
The burden comes in upon review. And if there is a challenge saying that the defendant did not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily relinquish that, then the burden is placed on the state on review. But at the hearing itself, the state is not burdened with establishing that the defendant is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily relinquishing that right. And I think we can look at that in the competency hearing context as well. Competency to not be tried while incompetent is a right. Competency on post-conviction review under Deborah A.E. is a right. And so if we take that context, this isn't an adversarial proceeding. This isn't a suppression hearing. This is whether or not the defendant is, in fact, competent. We're not concerned about whether the state is able to prove them under the rules of evidence, under a particular burden of proof, that they are competent or incompetent, but the actual fact of whether they are competent or incompetent.
Right. That's an interesting thing. Now it's come here. The trial court has said competent, right? What is the burden here? Because as you said, on review of voluntary relinquishing, intelligent waiver or relinquishing, on review, the burden is on the state. So who has the burden here?
I actually disagree with my opponent that the circuit court's ruling is before this court because it wasn't briefed by any of the parties until the reply brief. The issues presented were whether or not the correct burden of proof was presented in the circuit court, but not whether or not the circuit court's determination was clearly erroneous. And the same thing with the Court of Appeals. They did not address that issue. In fact, in this case, this has to go back for a hearing on the issue of competency yet. Competency has not been determined. So I think the first step that we have to get through is actually having this go back to the circuit court, a new competency hearing be done under the correct standard, and then whether or not the defense would like to challenge that ruling, then we will get to the next phase of this.
Well,
How
do you differ from the defendant? I think, isn't the defendant asking for a new hearing?
No, the defendant is asking this court to actually declare that the circuit court's ruling was clearly erroneous and for the court to order that a guardian be appointed to Mr. Daniel. And the state finds that to be incredibly inappropriate because right now, where we are in 2015, the circuit court's determination now is, I believe, over 3 years old. Could be quite possible that Mr. Daniel is now, in fact, competent to proceed or incompetent. We don't know because the evaluations are so old at this point. I think it's appropriate that it be remanded for a new hearing.
Ms. Winter, I really misunderstood your brief. I'm looking at page 20.
Mm-hmm.
It says, for the foregoing reason, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision that defense counsel bears the burden of proving Daniel incompetent.
Yes.
By the greater weight of credible evidence. Today, I hear you saying that, that issue of the incompetency isn't even before us, if I understood you. Then you say, since the competency evaluations are now more than 3 years old, on remand, the circuit court should exercise its discretion to determine the method for evaluating whether Daniel is currently competent. So you don't ask us to determine the method. You don't ask us to say there's no burden. You ask the trial court to do that. Then you say defense counsel requests that this court conclude that Daniel was proved incompetent in the prior hearing and remand only for appointment. The request is inappropriate, even if Daniel could be found incompetent by the greater weight. Turn the page. If Daniel has regained competency, then you have to do something else. Since at the time, appointing a guardian doesn't make any sense. So what is it, in light of the fact that I hear something different today than I read, what exactly is it you want us to do?
I acknowledge that the conclusion in my brief is not what I argued to this court. And I think that is just partly a factor of having prepared for oral argument and realizing that is not the position that the state
and
is I'm actually asking.
I'm not criticizing you for changing your conclusion, because I think that it's better to have seen something, even if later, than never to have seen it at all. Other people have said that more better than I have, but essentially I believe that. So I just want to know what you think, and whether you really are all on the same page that you need a new competency hearing no matter what happens. And then if there is such a competency hearing, I want to know what's the burden of proof.
I believe that a new competency hearing is required in this case, and that the proof, that there has to be a quantum of proof that is the preponderance of the evidence to establish that Mr. Daniel is incompetent.
Okay, right. And so whoever is then seeking to have him declared incompetent clearly has to satisfy that by the preponderance of the evidence. So the burden of proof has got to lie on the movement, as it usually does in a motion, right?
Correct.
Okay. Let me just—you just said correct that, but I need to know what your position is, because I'll tell you what I heard you say 4 or 5 minutes ago. What I heard you say 4 or 5 minutes ago was no one has the burden. It's like when you decide whether or not a plea was knowing voluntary, you know, and at the hearing itself, no one has the burden. It's only on review, you said, that someone has the burden. So I need to know at this hearing that everyone seems to, at a hearing, if there is a hearing, a new competency hearing with a burden that is a preponderance, is it your position that the defense counsel has the burden at the hearing, or is it your position that no one is assigned the burden? You just all present it and the judge decides. Which is it? Because I hear you saying both.
I think there's some confusion because I'm not being clear, and that's my fault, between the burden of production and the burden of persuasion. Right. I think at the hearing, no particular party is saddled with a burden of persuasion. The movement is saddled with the burden of production to establish the facts that support the request of the court to find the defendant incompetent. And I'm sorry I wasn't clear on that, but that's what I meant.
That's not the language of the statute, though, and that's where that kind of I'm not sure that I'm with you on that. The statute does set forth various burdens, and I thought that case law said, to the extent possible, we apply the statute.
That is true, and that's why the state has argued that the presumption of the burdens under 97114 subsection 4B should not apply in post-conviction competency determinations, because the rationale behind the presumption and the burdens of proof that correspond to those presumptions are specific only to the context of competency to stand trial.
I'm not even convinced. I mean, I know we have case law now that says that to the extent you can, you apply these statutes to post-conviction proceedings, and part of the language of the statute seems to indicate you do. But when I read these statutes and the way it works, as I understand it, part of the competency hearing is, will this person be able to regain competency within the requisite period of time? And if they can, great, then it's on hold while they regain competency. If they can't, then the person is discharged. That's what the statute calls for. So what do you do in a post-conviction proceeding?
I think for...
as to the requisite time period.
Sure. First, for a point of clarity, Deborah A.E. only says that we follow 971.14 subsection 4 to the extent feasible, not the entire 971.14 statute. Subsection 4 is only specific to the hearing for the competency determination. So in the post-conviction context, there is no suspension of proceedings if the defendant is found incompetent. And it is based on what question is being put forward to the court. In this case, the question is Daniel competent to decide to forego post-conviction relief? And so in this circumstance, I am in agreement with the opponent that if Daniel is found incompetent, the proper next step under Deborah A.E. is that a guardian is appointed to make the decision for Daniel.
And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked counsel. I know that's what Deborah A.E. says. Have you taken a look at the statute that it cites for authority for that, 880.33?
I did, but I don't have recollection of it at this moment. I know in
it's a probate area, and 880, I'm not even sure is there anymore.
No, that all was revised. It was put into 51 and 48 was for the children.
So they're probate statutes.
Been changed.
That's not a criminal law statute. That's a probate statute.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
The rationale behind the establishment of a guardian in Deborah A.E. is simply that there is more harm to the defendant in waiting to pursue post-conviction proceedings than there is in not. And the competency...
Yeah, but I mean, the idea to appoint a guardian kind of is made up, really.
It is, yeah. I would agree with that.
Statutory authority for that.
I would agree with that. I think the Deborah A.E. court was attempting to fashion a particular way that we can have... protect the defendant's right to post-conviction review without stopping the proceedings if they are incompetent. And that is because the defendant is already confined. He's already been afforded due process in trial. He's already been convicted. His liberty has already been deprived. The longer that we wait for a post-conviction defendant to regain competency, the longer the potential deprivation of liberty occurs if he does have a meritorious issue that would either reduce his sentence or overturn his conviction. So the liberty interest operates in the opposite fashion in post-conviction proceedings than it does in competency to stand trial. And that's why I think the Deborah A.E. court was attempting to figure out how we can get post-conviction proceedings to continue when the defendant isn't competent to make the decisions committed to him by law.
And the court gets authority about appointing guardians in the incompetency provisions that were in 880. I think they're in 51 at the moment.
That's probate, though. That's not in the criminal competency provisions, unless I missed it. I'd love it if you could point it out.
In the civil commitment?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, in the civil.
Then do you want to overturn Deborah? You want to change Deborah?
I would like this court to affirm Deborah A.E. and clarify that in Deborah A.E., where it says to follow subsection 4 to the extent feasible, that does not mean that the court should follow that statute's mechanism for creating and rebutting presumptions of competence or incompetence.
So you're just interpreting to the extent feasible?
Correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Urich? So do you agree with the state now?
About what, Chief Justice?
About, one, is the preponderance of evidence. Two, you don't have the burden of persuasion. The state doesn't have the burden of persuasion. You might have the burden of coming forth with the evidence, which under Johnson you'd have to do, right? Because that's your ethical obligation. of bringing forth what you know. So, and then it goes forth without anyone having the burden, and then you look at burdens only on review. I'm not sure I agree with all that, but that's what I heard.
You got to have a burden or nobody wins. I mean, come on, we're in an adversarial proceeding. When you come down to the bottom line, I mean, usually when you do a burden of production and a burden of persuasion, it's because the burden is going to shift, oftentimes in employment law. You know, there's a burden of production for an employee, and then it shifts to the state in certain circumstances to pick it up. But I don't notice that in any of our statutes. So it's a big mystery to me how you can advocate for a position and not have the burden of persuasion if you think you're going to win on the position. You can maybe explain it.
No, Justice Rogensack, I agree. We have an adversarial system, and I think that the state's recommendation takes us outside the context of an adversarial system.
Listen, you're halfway home. You ought to take what you get. You started out here that you have the total burden, evidence, persuasion, production. The whole bit. So now you got the state saying, oh, no one has the burden. I mean, I'm not sure I understand how that works. Yeah. And I gave the example of equally divided evidence and that the burden is. But so what do you think? You want the state to have the burden, don't you?
All the time, Your Honor. Yes.
Yeah, I understand that. I'd be under reasonable doubt, right?
I won't advocate that at this hearing.
Okay.
Chief Justice, you had asked about dates between competency hearings. Roddy was charged in September of 2008. There was a reverse waiver hearing filed in September of 2008, decided in May of 2009. Competency to stand trial was considered from March to May in 2010 and decided in May of 2010. The trial itself took place immediately afterwards in May of 2010 when he was convicted. And then our post-conviction competency hearing occurred on June 13th, 2012.
2 years.
That's correct. Somewhat over 2 years ago.
It's in a month.
Mm-hmm. To address some of...
He's been in prison in that time, right? Or an institution.
Oh, he has, yes.
Okay.
And to the point of presumptions, I don't think that the fact of a civil commitment while he's in prison is determinative of his competency to stand trial, but it is informative. I believe that his competency to stand trial determination was informative. I believe that all these things can inform a circuit court's decision about post-conviction competency without creating presumptions or rebuttable presumptions, but rather they're just information. I think that it's inconsistent for the state to suggest that we ought to continue the competency to stand trial determination in full force and effect until proven otherwise. I think it's inconsistent for a couple of reasons. Because he has been found incompetent before and since in the context of his competency to refuse treatment, and B, the competency to stand trial is different from competency to pursue post-conviction relief. They're simply different functions. Competency to stand trial requires someone to be aware of who the players are, what the proceedings are. Competency to pursue post-conviction relief requires something fundamentally different. It requires a decisional competency to be able to make and stick with a decision for upward of 6 months, which Roddy demonstrably cannot do from the record. Briefly regarding determining whether or not the circuit court was clearly erroneous. I think that that would be appropriate given the thorough record that was developed. And I think that the state's arguments is what requires it. It wasn't raised for the first time in reply. It was raised for the first time in response. The state repeatedly frames this as an issue of Roddy's autonomy. And in some cases, post-conviction, that's going to be true. sometimes defendants post-conviction are going to want to assert their autonomy and say, I forgo the right to post-conviction relief. In order for this court to determine whether that's true in this case, they can look at the very thorough record we developed and I think very clearly conclude that Roddy was by no means competent.
Just seems to me all this time has passed, right? We're up to 3 years now, a little more than three. Seems to me that regardless of whether the first, whether the preceding matters were done right or wrong, you're going to need another competency hearing for post-conviction anyway. Unless you totally affirm, which you can't totally affirm, because the burden of proof is wrong. When I say burden of proof, I mean which level of burden. So it seems to me you have to go back, but it seems to me also that there has to be a decision by this court as to what the trial court does when it goes, if and when it goes back.
Chief Justice, true. It's been over 2 years since the competency proceeding. I can't imagine a time at which a competency proceeding comes before a court of appeal and the issue isn't too long ago, given the nature of competency determinations. And in effect, we don't want to insulate circuit courts from any review, even clearly erroneous review, because it always takes a few months to get in front of a court of appeals.
Well, Counselor, the court of appeals clearly recognized that when it said it wanted the other burden of proof other than the trial court, but it said Daniel's competency, if questioned on remand, shall be addressed de novo by the court. So obviously the court of appeals thought, well, if you bring it up again, when it goes back down on remand, if the court of appeals decision is upheld, then if you question it again, then you start all over again on this issue, correct? But depending then maybe on a different burden of proof or not, depending on what the court decides.
That's correct, Justice Rogensack. And while I recognize that remand is most likely, I do see as well that this is potentially an interminable cycle. I don't imagine that competency issues are ever going to be resolved, and eventually we're going to have to get to the merits of this case, if in fact Roddy or a guardian ever decides that an appeal is appropriate. But in the meantime, we're spinning our wheels on competency and not able to reach the real issues.
Other issues that you think are there? Well, this was an interesting and long one. We appreciate your spending the time after the red light and the interesting briefs and arguments on competency post-conviction and the statute. And so that ends our hearing, and I appreciate the, on behalf of the court, the arguments in brief of Mr. Urich, Mr. Hayman, and Ms. Winter. So we conclude 2012 AP 2692 CR State versus Roddy Daniel. The court will meet in closed session. It's now, according to my watch, 3:20, so we'll meet at 3:45. We are in recess until our next oral argument and third oral argument in January.